Hey everybody, it's time again for F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley. I am joined tonight by JB.
It's past my bedtime.
Go to bed. Tonight we are talking about Frank Darabont's The Mist from 2007. But before we do that, I have to remind everybody that once again, you can find our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com and on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. And on Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. And you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com with suggestions for shows or feedback. Write down the email address. It's going to come in handy in the coming weeks. JB, good to have you back after Scary Movie Month. Are you recovering?
I have fully recovered. The doctors are impressed by my rate of recovery.
Have you watched a horror movie since the end of October?
Wow, that's a good question. Have I?
I don't know.
I think I'm taking a break. As we've commented before, October is just becoming this dizzying thing.
Yeah.
Especially with the F This Movie, F These Scary Movies 7-word review affair that I tried to contribute to. I think a break is in order.
We had originally planned to do The Mist as part of Scary Movie Month on F This Movie, and of course, it just got away from us because that month is a marathon, not a sprint.
And when Patrick says it got away from us, we were actually poised to do it, and then something reached out of the mist and grabbed his laptop, so it literally got... What's that in the mist?
Right. And we say mist, even though it's clearly fog. JB, have you seen anything good lately?
Anything good?
Have you seen anything lately?
I know what you've seen lately, because a few days ago, my lovely wife and I are driving away from the theater of choice, and all of a sudden she says, "Look who's in front of us!" And it's none other than Patrick Bromley, driving away from the same theater. And then, in a very dangerous fashion, we tried to communicate with him. I had one hand on the wheel, and my other hand was furiously making letters in what I thought was a backwards way that he could see in his rearview mirror. I was unsuccessful. However, making the letter J, because I was wondering if he had just seen J. Edgar, succeeded in him saying, silently, that he had seen Jack and Jill. And then he made the universal gesture for blowing his own brains out. We went to see Anonymous. And it's bad.
Yeah.
It's bad, 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 bad. But worth seeing, maybe.
Okay.
Netflix Instant, cable, Channel 9 at 3 o'clock in the morning. For the set design and the costumes and all the stuff that might get it some nominations in the technical categories. It's a wonderful recreation of the period. It is so confusingly directed and structured. It's as if the filmmakers knew that their dubious premise could not hold water. And so there's a bewildering series of flashbacks and flash forwards. And I'm not the stupidest man on the planet.
That would be me.
But it had me confounded. In fact, they keep having different actors playing characters younger or older. And because of that in the editing, I actually thought the young version of someone and the old version of someone were two completely separate characters.
Nice.
Also, and look out, this might be the topic of a shitting on the classics pretty soon. The contempt that it has for Shakespeare and that film's desire to present him as a fool is really insulting.
And why is that? Just because that's the premise of the movie? Or did the screenwriter just have it in for Shakespeare?
There are a group of people who insist that no one of such common parentage and education could have ever written those plays. So it had to be someone who was aristocratic. The same belief that doubts whether Lennon and McCartney could have written those songs because they were working class boys. Essentially, it's a classist argument. And there's a wonderful article on Slate, if anyone wants to find it, where an actual Shakespeare scholar sort of debunks this whole thing lock, stock, and barrel. I guess the people who believe that Shakespeare didn't write his own plays are referred to as Oxfordians because they believe the Earl of Oxford wrote them.
The Earl of Oxford.
again, the bottom line is... I wrote a new play!
And I'm having a stroke! That's from The Simpsons. That ultimately, it's like people can't wrap their head around genius.
Right.
How could he have written those plays? Well, because he wasn't like you and I.
But we're also at a point, I think, where no one is willing to accept anything that we call everything. There's a group of people yes. willing to call every single thing into question. The timeliness of this conversation, just a little while ago, what was jammed anonymously, see what I did with the title, into your mailbox?
Well, I went to my mailbox and I was expecting mail.
Sure.
Maybe a catalog or bills, or if I got lucky, a Blu-ray from Amazon if it's Tuesday or Wednesday. And there were these homemade DVDs put in my mailbox anonymously. I'm guessing it wasn't the postman. And they're held together by a rubber band. And one of them is about something about Obama. And one of them is about 9/11 conspiracies.
Loose
and,
change. Lots of people have heard of it.
I'd really like to know which of my neighbors is a crackpot.
Yeah, that's not cool at all.
But
again, it's this thing. It's just, I don't believe anything. Everything is fake. We didn't land on the moon.
That too many people are forming their self-image and their self-esteem by being contrary. They're patting themselves on the back for being not dupable. Like,
right.
You can't fool me with that.
Right.
And that's kind of dangerous.
And Armin White, who we were just talking about before hitting record, is building a career out of this. And not only can he not be duped, but everyone else is being duped sort of in reverse. That everyone is duped into thinking that Jack and Jill is one of the worst movies of the year. But really, it's this brilliant comedy that evokes a fine tradition of,
that's
of
about,
Jewish
That's about
comedy.
Pride and ethnicity
right.
And stuff like that. And
right.
Again, I bring this up a lot in class. I use the quote from the REM song, What's the Frequency, Kenneth, when Michael Stipe sings. He says that irony was the shackles of youth, that we think hipness and irony is going to set us free, but it actually doesn't. It does the exact opposite, because now we don't know what anyone means, and we don't know who is just being sarcastic. And ultimately, I always describe it as the mirror reflecting the mirror. Is Armin White a put-on? Is that what he really believes? What the hell?
Either way, he's an asshole who should be ignored. Because either he's an idiot who thinks Jack and Jill is brilliant, or
he's doing it to get a rise out of us.
And he's still an asshole who should be ignored.
And you've brought him up on the podcast before. If you go to the F This Movie Facebook page, there's a link to this lunatic review of Jack and Jill. Read it for yourself and decide.
Back to Anonymous. It's Roland Emmerich, right?
Yeah.
And I kind of like Roland Emmerich movies for their goofy stupidity, but this is not Roland Emmerich in his wheelhouse.
Roland Emmerich's forte is not the costume drama. Enough said.
Anything besides Anonymous? You saw Tower Heist. How was that?
Well, believe it or not, I think you liked Tower Heist more than I did.
Sure.
There wasn't a lot there for me.
No.
It was so... by the numbers.
Yeah.
And
I thought it had a good first half hour.
What you had commented on in your review, that for a mainstream Hollywood film, I was really giving it mad props for how angry it was about the current financial situation.
Yeah.
And I really, really liked that part. And I will admit, spoiler alert, that when the car is dangling from the wire, I thought that was interesting, and mm-hmm. I thought it was well photographed, and I thought it was honestly thrilling,
mm-hmm.
but that was 3 minutes and
yeah.
what was otherwise.
Once the heist starts and Eddie Murphy kind of enters the movie, it falls apart, I thought.
And
I liked it because I was in the mood for it, I think.
And again, to give credit where credit is due, we had that trailer shoved down our throats
yeah.
for so many months,
yeah.
and everyone in the film did this media blitz and on and on and on. From the first time we saw the trailer, my wife said, there's something with the pool. There's something with the pool. The fact that it's there, the way it is, the way
yeah.
it's photographed, she said, there's something with the pool. And when the reveal came in the theater, it was like, aha, I told you, it's something with the pool, which does not mean you should go see Tower Heist. There are better films.
There are, but not many, because yesterday, and listen, we're halfway through November as of today, really. Yesterday or today, I sat down to try and knock out a top 10, what would be on it if the year ended tomorrow. I think I had four.
I was going to say, not 10.
No, I think I had four. One of them was Winnie the Pooh.
Which we saw together.
Yeah.
I have such high hopes for J. Edgar. The critics have not been kind, although a student who listens to this podcast told me this afternoon that he saw it, and he actually liked it a lot. So
I thought the trailer, and again, I'm just basing this on the trailer, I thought the trailer played like a parody of a biopic.
And again, maybe this has something to do with our earlier comment about irony and sarcasm and not knowing what anything means. But could it just be a sign of our advancing age that lately everything, a.k.a. J. Edgar, and especially the trailer for Jack and Jill, seems to us to be the joke version of something in an alternate universe that would be presented for our amusement because it was mocking something? Like the fake trailers in Tropic Thunder, it seems like those movies are being made.
They are being made. Yeah. And is it just a symptom of it sort of reverse engineering, that the people who have made those sort of joke trailers have gotten so good at nailing exactly what that is, that they're so attuned to what makes these things so cliched or familiar that now we're recognizing those things in reverse.
But we should point out, I'm sure of this, that Patrick and I see a lot more movies than a normal person.
Yes.
And so when I say that I had the Tower Heist trailer shoved down my throat, it's only because I'm maybe going to the movies three times a week, yeah, and you see the same trailer.
And there are situations where you're just so relieved that a movie is out because now it means you can stop seeing the trailer.
Yeah, and sometimes you see the trailer for so long, and obviously you have no interest in seeing the film, that the film's actual release sort of evades your interest. Right. And then months later, I'll see that it's coming out on video, and my response will be, that came out? Because I guess some things are easy to ignore.
Jack and Jill was such a depressing experience that even the trailers beforehand were depressing me with just what terrible movies are yet to come. There's only one other movie, because there's not much for me to say about Jack and Jill, except it's one of the worst movies maybe that I've ever seen.
And by using the Google,
yes,
which I understand is part of the internets, which as I understand is a series of tubes,
yes,
you can find Patrick's review of Jack and Jill, which is right on the money.
Yes, or you can find it on our Facebook page. It's so bad that honestly I was, in looking back and creating hyperlinks or whatever in my review, I realized that Adam Sandler and Happy Madison Productions have had four movies come out this year. Jack and Jill, Bucky Larson, Zookeeper, and Just Go With It. That coming off of Bucky Larson and Jack and Jill, I almost am looking back fondly at Zookeeper and Just Go With It, that I could easily watch any of those movies, either of those movies, a few times again before I could sit through Bucky Larson or Jack and Jill again.
And I actually saw both Zookeeper and Just Go With It with you.
Yes.
I thought Zookeeper was easily one of the worst films of the summer. And
oh, you haven't seen these other two.
Just Go With It. Well, I stayed away from Bucky Larson because yes, life is short.
Everyone stayed away from Bucky Larson, by the way.
And that Just Go With It was just demented in its badness.
Yes.
We've talked about this, I think, on a previous podcast, and that it was one of the worst comedies I had seen in maybe 5 years.
Again, you have not seen, because now looking back at Jack and Jill, there are a few, or not Jack and Jill, Just Go With It. There are a few things that I could say, well, I thought Jennifer Aniston did a good job in that movie. It had some nice, not photography, but locations. You know, what's her name?
Jennifer Aniston was the only saving grace, and Just Go With It.
It has Sports Illustrated swimsuit model
in a swimsuit.
Jack and Jill has fucking Adam Sandler in drag. You know what I mean? Like, I would watch Just Go With It again, I guess is my point.
Adam Sandler in drag, Al Pacino collecting a paycheck,
which is a drag.
But But what was I going to say? That I loved when you said, and obviously you're joking, but maybe you've hit on the truth, that the conspiracy theory is Adam Sandler and the others at Happy Madison, that this is actually some sort of plot to see who can make the laziest, stupidest film and have it still make money. And that they chortle their dark laughter and they collect their paychecks. And
but again, even that comes from a place of cynicism. That comes from the guys who made Loose Change. Everything is a conspiracy. I can't take this because I can't believe that somebody could make a movie this shitty on purpose. But you know what I mean. It's funny.
At the beginning of his career, I was a big fan of Sandler. Mostly because of Happy Gilmore, which yes. I thought had a few touches that were just
yes.
wow.
And Billy Madison as well. And again, the frustration with something like Jack and Jill is that every once in a while, Adam Sandler will do a Punch Drunk Love or a Funny People, which, flawed as it may be, he's very good in and is ambitious. So we know that he's capable of better. He's just not interested in doing better.
Well, he doesn't have to, and you always cite the box office statistic. How much did Grown Ups make?
$150 million? I don't know.
That makes me weep for Civilization.
I would watch it 10 more times before I would watch Jack and Jill.
Which you had mentioned.
The only other movie I want to talk about really quickly is a movie that is either currently in limited release or coming out in limited release and is available via video on demand, and it's a movie called I Melt With You. Have you read about this?
No.
Mark Pellington, a guy who used to do music videos and has directed a couple movies, most notably Arlington Road, which is a movie I wasn't crazy about, directed it. It stars Jeremy Piven and Rob Lowe and Thomas Jane, who's in the movie we're talking about tonight, and one other actor whose name I don't remember, but he played Orson Welles in Me and Orson Welles. And it's about these four friends who get together every year and complain about their lives and how they're not the men that they thought they would be. And this movie, I almost want you to see because I think it would make your head explode. For as many issues as you have with someone like, say, Darren Aronofsky, he's got nothing on this movie. It is, at one point, I think in order to convey a character's deteriorating mental state, it shows footage of the Challenger explosion. It is well made in the sense of like, well, that certainly edited a lot of footage together.
And, that was a thing.
Right. And, you know, the guy knows how to maybe compose a shot, but goes so far overboard in the way that like Tony Scott does. It is pretentious in a way that I couldn't believe. It is sort of Neil LaBute by way of Terrence Malick. Neil LaBute is a producer on the movie, so it's just four guys sort of self-destructing.
He did an uncredited rewrite. You know, for just a second there, when you were describing the plot, I thought, bunch of middle-aged guys talking about how their life didn't turn out. I would be interested in that.
And it starts... and
great
it's,
premise.
It starts, and it's a movie that you've seen 100 times, and they start doing cocaine, and it's a movie you've seen 100 times, and then it starts to get really dark, and you're like, well, I don't know where this is going, and by the end, it has become unintentional comedy.
It sounds like a film, and it's late, and I can't remember the title, but I'm going to tell you what I think the title is in my head,
okay.
And it's ludicrous, and okay. You're going to tell me
all right.
The real title.
Okay.
Shiftily, Shiftily Last.
What? Hurly Burly.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a fun game. We should play that more on If This Movie.
That's how good we are. Man, I'm so impressed.
Definitely, definitely elements of Hurly Burly in the movie.
You mean Shiftily, Shiftily, Shiftily Last?
Shiftily, Last. I want to say don't seek it out because I thought it was really bad. But at the same time, I think you should seek it out because it just goes so crazy. Not in a good way that you can't believe... because they're making this movie seriously. They think they're making this profound statement on masculinity. And it is a mess.
One night,
yeah.
I will be alone with nothing to do. And I will find it on video on demand.
Yeah.
Because what I've noticed, what we were talking about, because we recently posted a column about movies that most people are not familiar with and that you should see. And Patrick's was The Nines, which I realized I first saw because he showed it to me. As was the case with The Mist, when The Mist was released to theaters, I missed it.
Yeah, missed it?
Oh, that was completely accidental.
You missed it. Was it?
It was.
There are no accidents. 9/11 was an inside job, loose change. I put it in your mailbox. I am the Duke of Oxford.
I knew it was you.
I planned 9/11.
For just a second, I thought the Quibbler was going to return.
He might.
I don't think the Quibbler is ever going to return.
No. I would play the Quibbler tonight as we talk about The Mist.
Okay.
Yeah.
That the first time I saw The Mist, Patrick was showing it to me at his house. It was part of Scary Movie Night.
No, it was not.
It was the other.
Yes.
It was the.
Yes.
Do we talk about that?
We could talk about it. Every year, I plan a day of movies around my birthday. It's usually exactly what this list just was, which is like movies I really like that maybe not everybody has seen. And sometimes it's The Mist and it's great. And sometimes it's Southland Tales. And that blows up in my face.
I've been asked not to talk about Southland
Tales. No, you have not. You slept during Southland Tales.
Yeah, I did. that I first saw The Mist at Patrick's house. And again, I had missed it when it was in the theaters. Sorry, I repeated the joke. And I think maybe deliberately, because at that point, the Stephen King adaptations were a case of diminishing returns. But love The Mist. It's still, I don't think it gets the accolades it deserves. That I think slowly people's opinions are changing. Although I think when it came out, it got decent reviews.
It did. It just didn't do any box office. And I should say that the reason we came to do The Mist was because one of our very favorite listeners, Adam Risky, suggested that we do it. And like I said, we had planned to do it during Scary Movie Night, or not Scary Movie Night, Scary Movie Month, and yes, we were not able to, so we're getting to it now. Sorry, Adam.
And we met Adam at the Music Box Massacre.
We did, and it was delightful. The Mist didn't really make any money when it came out.
And I know why, and at the end of the podcast, I will tell you why it didn't make any money.
Spoilers to come, but I think even without that, it wouldn't have made money. And I honestly believe the reason is, A, Stephen King movies don't tend to do major box office, especially now. I mean, in the 80s, they were more of a sort of an industry. But audiences aren't that interested in monster movies.
And also, and you've pointed this out, whether it was in a column or a podcast, I don't know. I believe it was your review of The Woman.
Okay.
That horror fans are a peculiar lot. And they will bitch and moan about how there's nothing new under the sun, and that everything's a remake, and everything's a sequel. And then something amazing comes out. I would put The Woman under that category. And they don't go to see it.
Yeah.
Or they go see it and they shit on it for some reason. And I don't think horror fans embrace this. I think it didn't have big stars.
Right.
Which might have been a reason.
Yeah.
And I would suggest the title is uncommercial.
Definitely. Because I didn't know even that it was a monster movie until just before it came out. I knew that I had not read the story. I knew that he was making this movie called The Mist. And it wasn't until, you know, I started to see a few TV spots that I was like, oh my gosh, there's monsters. Great. But even the diehard horror audience isn't enough to make a movie a success. It has to break beyond those people. It has to be, you know, a Paranormal Activity or even like a Saw, where people who maybe aren't necessarily horror fans are going to see it for whatever reason, teenagers mostly.
But I'm coming to the point, and the whole theme of tonight seems to be conspiracy and weirdness and the two of us.
We will talk about the movie at some point.
The two of us thinking we're better than everyone else.
Well, that's the theme of this entire podcast.
That if a movie makes a lot of money,
yeah,
a lot of money,
yeah,
that means it's bad.
Oh, I don't necessarily believe that.
I do.
Okay. Inception made a bunch of money.
You've proved me wrong, Patrick Bromley.
True Grit made over $100 million. Transformers Revenge of the Fallen, boatloads. Brilliant movie.
Okay,
great now, canted angles,
now,
says Armand
okay,
White.
Armand White. That now you're proving my point. Here's what I mean.
Yes.
Very often,
yes,
movies that make, okay, this is going to be the sentence full of qualifiers. Very often, not all the time, but sometimes, some, not all, movies that make a lot of money aren't particularly good.
I would
all
agree
I'm
with
saying
that
is box office, yes, performance doesn't equal.
Absolutely.
And that when something really good and special comes out, it's almost like it takes people 3 years,
yes,
to kind of figure it out.
Yeah.
Office Space.
Yes.
Is a great example of that.
Yeah.
A failure at the box office, yeah, now regarded as a classic. A Christmas Story. Yeah. It's a Wonderful Life. The list goes on and on. That if there isn't a huge initial audience, one can hope that through various means, people will find their way to the film and finally acknowledge that this is unbelievable. Did the advertising campaign stress that this was the team that brought people Shawshank Redemption?
I think so. And what's interesting about what you're saying is that, you know, Frank Darabont built his reputation on exactly what you're talking about. People did not go see The Shawshank Redemption when it came out. It was a movie that was discovered on video and endless showings on TNT. And now, as we know, it is the best movie of all time.
Well, it's certainly beloved. And I actually found out that this is the one Darabont wanted to make first.
Yeah.
And couldn't get financing.
Right. The Green Mile, I think, made money. But, you know, his movies, I guess, The Majestic, I don't think did. So, you know, I think even people that liked The Shawshank Redemption would have seen commercials for this and said, well, that doesn't look like
The Shawshank Redemption.
And it's not. And it's interesting, too, that Frank Darabont now is sort of regarded as very much the hero of the horror genre. Even though when he made one straight-up horror movie, he had written several in the 80s, when he made one straight-up horror movie, nobody went to see it. So I think that reputation that he has now is based on The Walking Dead.
Yes.
Which is a show he doesn't even work on anymore.
But he did produce it. He did bring it to fruition. I believe he directed the pilot.
He did.
Which I still think is the single best episode they ever did, because that's becoming something with diminishing returns. Yeah. Although The Walking Dead, which I'm still watching,
and
still hanging on. Greg Nicotero gets an executive producer credit in that, and his group is doing the makeup and effects. And in fact, Nicotero worked on The Mist. Should we talk about this now, or should we wait?
Talk about what? The Mist? The movie?
We're supposed to talk about The Mist?
At some point.
You said this was the general rambling.
Oh, episode. All right. Well, listen, we've done a fine job of that. Let's talk about The Mist.
He was major ramblings, and then he was promoted to general ramblings. That when they made this film, Darabont wanted the creatures. There are creatures in this film.
There are.
It's a monster movie. There's creatures in The Mist.
Correct.
He wanted them to look unlike creatures in any other movie.
Yes.
And so he got two really talented guys to work on the film, both of whom I've met.
Oh.
Bernie Wrightson is an illustrator. He does amazing illustrations. His specialty is dinosaurs. He does these beautiful books with sort of dinosaur paintings. But he's done everything. He's done album covers and he's done magazine covers, and Bernie Wrightson is great. In fact, every year I go to Wonderfest, which is a fan convention in Louisville, Kentucky. It's always Memorial Day weekend. I recommend it. And Bernie Wrightson is often a guest. And he did, every year they have a t-shirt that you can buy, because what is an event without a commemorative
t-shirt? How would you remember you were there?
I wouldn't. I have to go through my middle drawer to learn about my past. We'll just leave it at that.
Stephen King's next story.
Hey, it sounds like something out of a Stephen King book. And I think Wrightson gets the award. He designed the single best t-shirt Wonderfest has ever had. It was this beautiful drawing of Julie Adams in The Creature from the Black Lagoon, standing there in her white bathing suit, holding the creature supine in a reversal of the shot you've seen thousands of times.
Right.
It's my favorite t-shirt. And Greg Nicotero has been a guest at Wonderfest and does this amazing two-hour lecture, rant, slideshow. Here's what we do. Here's what we had. Oh, it's just the berries.
He's a super cool guy. Yeah. I really like anytime he's interviewed or he talks about stuff.
And speaking of which, I think you can find this on the Google or the YouTube. Last year, he made this little short film called The United Monster Talent Agency.
Yes.
Oh, if you're a fan of Universal Monsters, it's a little...
Yeah.
Oh, very this is the greatest thing.
Yeah.
So Darabont gets these two very talented guys, and he gives them one directive. Darabont wants the monsters to be different. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want them to be like the monsters in any other monster film. And I think they succeeded.
And The Mist afforded them that because there are several different creatures
right.
running around.
And they're
around
all sort of variations on existing, you know, this is a spider, this is a vulture, a bird.
An enormous lobster.
This is the Cloverfield monster.
This is, well, but this came first.
I know.
So at this point, we pick up the second laptop.
Listen, we are a big time podcast. We have two laptops, okay? We're like CTU up in this bitch.
I'm showing Patrick this for the first time. This is on the YouTubes.
Okay, it's called Two Girls, One Cup.
That's on YouTube?
I assume so.
That must be on the restricted YouTube channel where you can actually see Gaddafi get sodomized.
Oh, jeez.
Imagine the fun. This is from The Angry Red Planet.
Which is a movie.
And I've made this point before in previous podcasts.
Yes.
But I would suggest that what you're about to see, I'm actually playing this for him now.
If you want to play along at home, Angry Red Planet, Martian Bat Rat Spider.
Will be your search term in YouTube.
Yeah.
And I'll give you a couple seconds. Open a new window. YouTube. Angry Red Planet,
Two
Martian
girls,
Bat Rat. Stop with that.
Sorry, what?
That's poopy. That's bad. that's dirty. Dirty Patrick. Dirty Patrick.
Sorry.
Angry Red Planet, Martian, Bat, Rat, Spider. And I would argue that this, they think it's some sort of tree. Doesn't look like bark. Let me have your machete. Big mistake, Joan.
Oh.
It doesn't like that.
No, they took a chip out of the leg.
And I would say this is the precursor. Hold on, wait for the long shot.
Okay.
Of all of these, there it is.
Oh, yeah.
See what I mean?
It is, yeah.
The towering one.
Yeah.
And that
it's Cloverfield, it's Super 8, it's the big thing at the end of The Mist.
Which is exactly what I wrote here, that in trying to be different, much like Blade Runner did for science fiction film, it sets this course
right.
for other monster films where it has to be biological.
Right.
That it has to be composed of different pieces, that it clearly owes a lot to CGI, that it's a very CGI-ish monster.
Well, and again, you know, that right there, combining bat, rat, spider, it's just like, well, what are the three scariest things that we have, you know? Well,
and in The Mist, you definitely see them doing that, yeah. Because you have that enormous monster at the end, which I think is that whole Godzilla trope where it's this big thing and it's coming for you.
Right.
And then you have insects.
Right.
Those things that are trying to get through the window.
Right.
And then you get that crazy thing that's flying around in the supermarket.
Right. And again, I've not read the short story or novella, The Mist, but I'm on kind of a Stephen King tear right now. And it's interesting because I just finished reading From a Buick 8, which is a book about this sort of sheriff's department, ranger's department, that finds this car, and every once in a while it does these crazy things. It lights up, and things come flying out of the trunk. And because it's a book, he's able to say, you can't describe it. It just was fucked up looking. It was scary, but you can't even describe how scary this thing is. And there are a lot of things that reminded me of The Mist, including as the things sort of decompose, they just turn into this black kind of goo, and that's exactly what happens to the tentacle. That they find in The Mist. And so as I was watching The Mist and reading this book at the same time, I was noticing a lot of similarities. And I think that that's what Darabont was kind of going for. It's like, well, I want to create a physical version of this thing that you can't describe.
And that's incredibly difficult because you can easily see in the book something reached out of the mist and grabbed him.
Right.
It grabbed him. And took him away.
Right.
Now, once it's a movie,
right.
that has to be, well, it's a squid tentacle.
Yeah. And I like The Mist a lot. I like it a real lot. But I do have some, not even issues with the movie. I just think that there are things that could be talked about that I could be considered problems.
I like The Mist more than you do.
Okay.
But I will concede it's not a perfect film. But I think you should start along this string that you just started.
Well, I mean, there are obviously stupid little issues, like the fact that the CGI isn't great. Not a big deal. I can suspend my disbelief. And the reason for that, actually, is because Darabont had half, maybe a third of the budget he might have otherwise had, but he wasn't willing to change the ending. And Dimension was the only studio that said, sure, you can make the movie with that ending, but only for this much money.
We will get to the ending at the end of the podcast. Right. And interestingly enough, it's not the ending of the novella.
Right. And I think the ending really is the thing that everyone walks away from the movie talking about. I think without it, maybe people wouldn't be talking about The Mist even as much as they do, which we already said maybe isn't that much.
I think there's things to like in The Mist that are apart from the ending.
I agree.
I happen to really like the ending.
Okay.
But I think the ending owes a lot to Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah. Well, and the whole movie does.
I was going to say that clearly this speaks to King's love of Night of the Living Dead. I mean, big parts of Maximum Overdrive are Night of the Living Dead.
Right.
And you might say, well, that's just a trope that's in a lot of horror films. But not really until Romero and company did it that way. And I even started to think that we get the Night of the Living Dead idea that there's a whole bunch of people trapped somewhere and they have to get along to survive. And, of course, people don't get along. Mm-hmm. But then I thought, well, this doesn't take place in a country farmhouse. I thought it was interesting that The Mist happens in a grocery store, which harkens back to Dawn of the Dead,
right,
where they're in a supermarket. So it's sort of like a colliding of those tropes.
But Dawn of the Dead, I mean, obviously the shopping mall was very much what the movie had on its mind. And I think in The Mist, it's just sort of coincidental that here's where a bunch of people might be.
But something struck me, and maybe I'm thinking too much about this. Maybe I'm excessively ruminating about it. But I think part of that is because I am currently directing a high school production of Night of the Living Dead.
The 1990 version.
No.
Oh, sorry.
The far superior 1968 version. And it's been adapted to the stage, and it's going to be on stage with live zombies. And, of course, this is at the high school where I work in northern Minnesota.
Live zombies is an oxymoron.
Zombie so real you can reach out and touch them. See, I'm starting to sound like a huckster. So I'm actively involved in Night of the Living Dead, and I find the supermarket setting of The Mist very interesting because one of the things Night of the Living Dead is suggesting, I think, and one of the things I think The Mist is very explicitly saying is they are trapped in a supermarket. There are advantages to that,
mm-hmm.
including having a whole bunch of food right there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in some way, Night of the Living Dead and The Mist are both saying that it's peculiar with human beings. They want to solve problems. They want to do something right. They want to do something adventurous. They want to find a solution. And sometimes the solution is stay where you are.
Right.
And human beings do not like to stay where they are, because to stay where you are is to deal with the fear. And to make some sort of attempt to improve your situation is at least you saying, I am actively trying to. Right. And in doing that, you don't have to sit there and wait for the authorities and deal with your fear.
Right.
Because the other problem, of course, is the longer you sit in the supermarket, the more really bad things happen, especially if one of the people you're trapped with is really religious.
Well, and let's get to that. But yeah, I mean, obviously I think one of the things too that the movie is dealing with is just how quickly does hopelessness set in. And if you're in the supermarket and you are already feeling hopeless, the idea is, well, I mean, they even say as much, like, I'd rather die out there trying than just waiting around in here where things are getting worse. I think at this point, while we're not going to get to the ending yet, I think we will be spoiling elements of The Mist if you haven't already seen it. I wouldn't necessarily listen any further because even though we may not be giving big things away, we'll be giving enough away that you should see the movie first before you listen to this.
And I think both of us would suggest that you see the movie.
Oh, definitely.
Because it's well worth seeing.
I think it's one of the best horror movies, definitely, of the last 10 years.
As do I.
I think it's one of Frank Darabont's best movies, even though I don't think he gets credit for that. You know, I tend to like monster... I've said this before, that I tend to like monster movies more than, say, slasher movies. And I think it's a really good monster movie, but I think it also works on the level of, because it's not really concerned with the monsters. That's not what the movie's about. It's about what happens to the people inside. Same with Night of the Living Dead. What people do to one another when trapped in this situation and how quickly things get out of hand. And I think that works in the movie, but I also think it's one of the things... I think it happens a little fast.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But again, the monster is an excuse to throw a whole bunch of different, varied people together and watch them interact. And that's the part I'm most interested in.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I think Night of the Living Dead is about, ultimately.
Right.
We have to get together. We have to cooperate to solve this problem. And isn't it interesting, in the case of Night of the Living Dead, that this character we really hate happens to have the best idea, and the ostensible hero of the piece is problematic for a number of reasons, including the fact that he's the only non-zombie who kills anyone, which we tend to overlook because he's the hero. And in this, I think someone might actually criticize the film for making it just a little bit too prosaic, that the film is very sure of who the good guys and who the bad guys are, I think.
Yeah.
And that it could do with a little bit more ambiguity.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I think it very effectively presents what happens when people are scared shitless. And when people are scared shitless, they'll do anything.
Definitely. Definitely. Let's talk about Mrs. Carmody, who I think, aside from the ending of The Mist, is the thing that you remember about the movie, is Marcia Gay Harden's performance as this religious zealot. And for a while, I think it's really interesting because, A, she's right about stuff, whether by coincidence or, totally by coincidence, because, whatever, our religious beliefs probably shouldn't play into it, but she's not right because of what the beliefs that she subscribes to. But what she is saying does come true. How's that?
Yeah.
But also because, like you said, people are scared and they're looking for something to...
And someone with the answers.
Right. Someone to believe in, someone who seems to know what they're talking about, and she's that person.
And there's a brief period where she's right.
Right. And so a section of the customers in the supermarket sort of become her flock, and they start listening to her and following her. And like I said, I think that happens a little quickly, but because the movie is taking place sort of in a compressed time frame, I understand why that has to be the case. I just think, as a critique of sort of maybe organized religion or just religious zealots in general, while I may side with what the movie has to say, like you said, I think it's pretty heavy-handed.
It's presented with a pretty broad brush.
And what I wish... Because one of the things that the movie sort of almost wants to say, but doesn't quite, and this kind of gets into the ending. So again, heavier spoilers, though I won't say exactly what happens. Maybe it's hinted at. One of the things that the movie sort of wants to say is it doesn't matter what your approach is, what your belief system is, you're kind of fucked no matter what. So if you're Andre Brower, and who is another problematic character, I think he gives a good performance, but again, he's the character Roger Ebert talks about Paul Gleason in Die Hard. He's the character who exists only to be wrong.
Yeah.
That's Andre Brower. And I think he's good. And his approach is very pragmatic. He's logical. He rejects what he's being told because that's not possible. That doesn't happen. There aren't monsters with tentacles, so I don't believe you. I'm going to venture out into the mist.
But I think part of that stretches credibility because two separate characters go into the back of the store
and then verify
something horrific.
And he still assumes a joke is being played on him.
You take me for a fool.
Right.
Which is sort of convenient.
Because he exists just to be wrong. But again, he is the logical one. Marcia Gay Harden is the total opposite of that, the sort of faith-based religious nut. And it doesn't matter because they both end up in the same place. And part of me wishes that there had been another religious character sort of in opposition to Marcia Gay Harden.
Well, two things about that. One of the reasons why that part of the film is one of my favorites is that Hollywood films seem very reticent to bring up religion at all.
Sure.
And so the minute someone's willing to deal with it on any level, especially in a horror film, I give it a lot of credit. My only problem with having a more measured religious person to offset the crazy screeching witch is that it reminds me of some Hollywood action movies that were made in the 70s and 80s, where if the villain was from a particular ethnicity, the film was always right. very careful to have one of the cops be of the same ethnicity. And, so it's like, well, he's one of the good ones.
And that's not even why I'm suggesting that they do it, because I'm not saying, hey, you're religion saying
so the,
needs...
So the film's argument would be more measured.
Not even that necessarily, because I think I'm still taking it to a dark place, which is, listen, you can use this for your crazy means, or you can practice the teachings of Christ in a more, you know, genuine way. It still doesn't matter whether you're the good religious kind or the bad religious kind. You're fucked. It doesn't help.
And it also points out...
I think
out,
that would have made the point. I don't mean, like, no, they should have had a more fair representation
no,
of
no,
a religious
no.
person.
I understand what you're saying now, yeah. and to a certain extent, I'm applauding this segment because films seldom talk about religion, and oddly enough, I think oftentimes when religion is presented, it is presented in this way,
mm-hmm.
and that it would be nice if a film decided to bring up the topic of religion. It could talk more about what people get out of it that's valuable
right.
or that can help us.
Right. And
religion
I think it still could
have painted very broadly.
And I think it could still end up in the place that this movie ends up, which I think would still have some pretty dark things to say, even about religion. But I just think it's painted in such broad strokes that it's only used to get people on your side and to get them to do what you want, which ultimately involves murdering people.
And clearly, when the store clerk character does what he does,
yes,
clearly we're meant to applaud that.
It becomes a laugh when Thomas Jane says, you know, thanks. And again, that's an instance where I wish the movie was willing to acknowledge that even the good guys just resort, you know, spoilers.
Yeah.
Even the good guys just resorted to murder, and that's not to be applauded.
And the entire plot revolves around them all surviving.
Right.
I thought
right.
we have to, and so that's counterproductive.
It just turns into a way to shut her up.
Interesting Marcia Gay Harden story. Two summers ago, my family goes to New York and sees a wonderful play that my wife cleverly got tickets for before it won the Tony for Best Drama. After
and
that,
is now coming out as a movie directed by Roman Polanski.
God of Carnage.
Right.
And are they changing the title?
The movie is the just film? Carnage, I believe.
Oh, good Lord.
Listen, God of Carnage. God, that has God in the title.
So we don't want to do that. So we saw God of Carnage on Broadway, and it's terrific. It's really amazing for a whole bunch of different reasons. And after the performance, the actors very nicely came out of the stage door and greeted their fans and signed programs and things. And so we sort of got a meet and greet with Hope Davis and Jeff Daniels and Marcia Gay Harden and
Gandolfini.
And James Gandolfini. And, of course, you want to say something nice while the person is signing your program. So Marcia Gay Harden is signing my program, and I say...
Loved you in Flubber.
Oh, I forgot she's in that. That actually would have been funnier than what I said. I said, I really, really liked your performance in The Mist. And she looked up from what she was doing. And she said, I'm really surprised that you bring up that film.
Mm-hmm.
Because no one
right.
talks about that film.
Yeah.
She seemed to appreciate the compliment there.
Well, definitely. And imagine, you know, as I'm complaining about sort of how broad the character is portrayed, imagine it. With a less talented actress.
I was going to say.
She's such a heavy hitter that she makes that work really well. And you can just imagine somebody less talented, how bad that would come off.
And the thing I like about the performance, and I think this is even hinted at in the dialogue, is that this woman is ostracized in the community. She's almost considered to be a witch.
Yeah.
And the situation that the film presents is finally her chance
mm-hmm.
to have her say.
Right.
And I thought that was interesting.
Definitely. I think, unfortunately, here's the thing. I like that Frank Darabont kind of has a little sort of stock company that he's
yeah.
developing. And a lot of those people show up on The Walking Dead, including an actress that he found doing The Mist. The woman who wants to get home to her kids
yeah.
is now on The Walking Dead. She's Sophia's mom. I don't remember her name. She was just some local actress that they cast doing The Mist, and apparently he liked her enough. I think everybody's fine in the movie, but I think Marcia Gay Harden is really the only performance that stands out to me. I think everyone else is a tad generic.
I like Thomas Jane, though.
Okay.
And I remember, I think it might have been when we saw this movie at your house, that suddenly people were reminding me of other things he had been in.
Mm-hmm.
And I had not connected the dots. And I don't think it was after I saw The Mist that I realized, oh, that's Mustache from Boogie Nights.
Right.
And then there was a third Thomas Jane performance.
Deep Blue Sea?
No.
The Punisher?
No, I knew that he was The Punisher.
I don't know.
There was a third.
Yeah.
Not that HBO show.
Right.
Any sitcom that pretends that someone's equipment could be bigger than mine, frankly, I shun. There was a third Thomas Jane performance, and given what's asked of him,
yeah,
given the character type, he has to be in The Mist.
Yeah.
I thought he did a really good job.
I think he is good. I think almost by nature that character maybe is a little bit generic.
Yeah.
Because he has to be. He's sort of the strong, determined everyman, which I, you know, Thomas Jane obviously does well. It's just that the character ends up being a little bit generic, and that's true actually of a lot of Stephen King heroes. You know, the Stu character in The Stand, who's ostensibly the lead, is one of the least interesting characters in the whole book. Like I said, everybody's good. It's just that hers is the only performance that I really come away from remembering.
It's sort of a showcase performance. Yeah, but again, definitely, as you said, imagining a lesser actress in the role.
Yeah.
You know, shows you what she's capable of doing.
Yeah. Do we want to talk about the ending now?
Yes.
Okay.
So.
Turn off this if you haven't heard it. Or seen it. What? Turn
the. I think most
people. What the hell did I just say?
Most people have
turned. Turn this off if you haven't heard it.
You don't need to say that. I think most people turned it off. I would peg it at the 16-minute mark.
Okay.
That horror fans are not interesting. Are not interested in seeing something new.
More interesting. Just kidding, horror fans.
That it was unfortunately titled.
Yeah.
That it was advertised in the wrong way. That it didn't have any big stars. But clearly, what everyone points to is one of the bleakest endings in recent memory.
Yes.
In fact, when we first saw it at Patrick's house, knowing when the film was made, it was 2007.
Yeah.
For a second, I thought I had misinterpreted the ending because there's no way that right. that went out.
Right.
They take off in the Jeep. The Jeep is in the mist. We hear monsters coming from far away, and the people in the car decide.
The Jeep runs out of gas, correct?
Yeah. The people in the car decide that they have this gun, and there's a number of bullets, and they no longer wish to continue.
Rather than be eaten by monsters, they take their own fates into their hands.
This they do, and then, I'm not sure, does the film make it explicit how much time passes between that act and...
The film suggests that it's real time, which makes it...
Crazy.
30 seconds?
Yeah.
1 minute?
30 seconds after they all commit suicide, the cavalry rides in, and it's the U.S. Army, and oh, but...
Just to be clear, it's not suicide for everyone. For Thomas Jane's sleeping 10-year-old child, it's murder.
Yes. And this is bleak, and this is not what we're used to, because when the hero takes off in a Jeep, we sort of expect him to ride off into the sunset.
Which is where the novel ends. Not riding off into the sunset, but just ambiguous.
And clearly that owes something to the birds,
right.
Which I always thought was very effective. I'm a fan of the open-ended ending. I don't think it's a cheat. And this is what happens when they drive away, but... from what I read, Darabont had King's, King thought it was fine.
Not only did he think it was fine, King said, I wish I would have thought of that myself.
Okay, so this was not, you know, something he pulled. And of course, when you want the ending of a film to be that, studios run away and studios give you less money because of this odd notion that, the last thing in a movie is very important because that's what people have in their brain pan when they walk out of the theater and start talking about it. And on a completely unrelated subject, I wonder if Titanic, which by all accounts has a very sad ending because 1,500 people die, if that's the reason why the movie Titanic ends with Jazz Heaven, where Rose and Jack are reunited, so we can feel happy and leave the theater and tell our friends to go see it.
Absolutely. This is what's waiting for us when we die, and that's not so bad. Leonardo DiCaprio, he looks very nice. Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely the case. And I think the ending of The Mist is really kind of a make it or break it for a lot of people. I've talked, not at length, Eric Asperschlager, who's on the show, watched it fairly recently, within the last year, and came away from it, I think, with a really bad taste in his mouth, specifically because of the ending. And I think it's the kind of thing where it's kind of a love it or hate it thing.
It's a bitter, bitter pill. Would this be Eric with an H?
This would be Eric with an H, yeah.
Just wanted to check. No, I could see some people really, I don't want to say feeling betrayed, but I know from 20 years of showing the original Night of the Living Dead in film study class, I've had students react to that ending, very similar ending, in very strange ways. I've had that ending get uncomfortable laughter because they don't know how to react to that.
And Night of the Living Dead has never felt like a cheat to me, and I wonder if it's just because of the political subtext, because of when the film was made. Because the ending of The Mist, to me, does feel like a cheat. It feels bleak for bleak's sake. It's not a decision that I totally understand, especially given the fact, again, because time is maybe compressed, they run out of gas, they don't wait very long to shoot everyone, and then seconds later, the cavalry arrives, and oh, sweet irony. And as I was watching The Mist today for the podcast, and this was also the same day that you wrote your column eviscerating Titanic and talking about how sort of easy and obvious so much of it is, I felt like, boy, The Mist does a little bit of that too. It's just in a different way. Instead of being corny and Jazz Heaven, it's easy, obvious irony. Oh, if I had just waited, and oh, look, the woman who wanted our help, and none of us would help her, none of us would help bake the bread, Chicken Little. She's on the cavalry, and she's fine, and she has her family with her, and I just murdered mine.
But given that we're talking that not many Hollywood films have an ending like this, I'm not so quick to call it easy irony, because I think there's far more films that end with Jazz Heaven than end this way.
I don't think it's easy irony in terms of box office.
No, but I think I agree with you that Darabont may have done it to distinguish his film from other films that insist on having happy endings.
Yes.
I just think that if that level of cynicism were easy and accepted, more films would end that way. Clearly, his intent is to give you a bitter pill.
Yes.
A somewhat obvious, overwrought bitter pill. I mean, it's...
And I guess that's what I mean by easy. I don't necessarily mean, like, this was the easy choice to make, or this would be accepted, because obviously it's not, and Darabont knew that. He had to work with half the budget.
But I agree with you. I agree with you that it screams irony.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Very, like a neon sign.
And it's, I mean, it's even done in such a heavy-handed way where it's a lot of slow motion and that music is just, and it takes a very long time.
All it's missing is for one of the military guys to look in the car. Why couldn't they wait?
Exactly.
Why couldn't they wait for 30 seconds? Fade out.
Right. I guess, I don't know, you know, it's the kind of ending that screams, you really have to think about it and ask yourself, is that the best ending for this movie? And while I don't necessarily have a better ending to offer, I don't necessarily feel like it is. I wonder if, and again, it's not a deal breaker for me because I still really like the movie, but I don't have a problem with King's original ending, which is just, They drive off. Do they make it? Do they not? Even if, and it's hinted at in the story that the narrator, I think, makes reference to how many bullets are in the gun that they have.
Right. It's certainly a more poetic ending.
Yes.
But again, going back to my point from 45 minutes ago, we see a lot of movies.
Yes.
And I like it when a movie tries to be different.
I do too. I guess I just...
It is a very unhappy ending.
Which that's not even necessarily what I'm responding to. My response is not, they should have lived, damn it. It's just the way that it goes about it.
Oh, well, that I completely agree. And yeah. I had forgotten, because I didn't rewatch it for the podcast. I watched it on cable about a month ago. I had forgotten that I Just Want to Get Back to My Kids is on the convoy.
I mean,
that's...
It's a little much, right?
It's rubbing salt into the wound of your unhappiness.
Right. I don't have a problem. You know, The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing, is one of my favorite horror movies of all time. Possibly one of my favorite movies of all time. And, you know, it's as bleak as movies get.
But here's what I would argue, and maybe this is something you're missing. If you're going to go the bleak route,
yes,
it's really good to have a great last line.
Mm-hmm.
And The Thing has a great last line.
Yeah.
And this does not. This has the sound of four bullets being fired.
And Thomas Jane screaming into the air as the army drives by and wonders, what's that guy screaming about? Oh, his dead family inside the car. I don't have a problem with them deciding to kill themselves. I just, again, maybe it's the way that it's timed. Maybe it's what's-her-name driving by in the car and the music and him screaming.
It is rather quick, but as we identified, maybe because it's a two-hour Hollywood film. 2 hours?
2 hours exactly, I think.
Why don't they put it in the same place on every box? I ask you.
Yeah, I don't know.
Anyway. Oh, wait. Oh, my God, is it small. 126 minutes.
Oh.
That, we've been complaining that a lot of things happen awfully fast.
Right.
And that has to happen because it's not a miniseries. The Misty Walking Dead.
Right. And I don't need 30 minutes of them sitting in the car, but even the suggestion that perhaps time has passed or that the monster is really getting close. Something to suggest that, I don't know, that they have to do this right now, and then that the army shows up right away. Maybe that's what I have an issue with, more than them deciding right away to kill themselves. Like, well, we gave it a shot. I mean, the characters basically say, we did our best, we gave it a shot, at least we have that. And there's a very nice moment where they all sort of come to terms with, this is it, this is the end for me. And that's great. And Thomas Jane, you know, shooting his son is, that's rough, man. Like, and that's all okay. Because I think maybe to that point, the movie earns that. It's just that 30 seconds later, the army shows up.
And so if we go back to Night of the Living Dead, which we've been comparing this film to for the whole podcast, at the end of Night of the Living Dead, when Ben is shot, we instantly go to this very odd montage of still pictures and his body being thrown on the pyre and this very unsettling music.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think what you're saying is if Night of the Living Dead more closely followed the Mist's archetype, Ben would be shot and then some character would run on, what have you done? Right. He wasn't a zombie! The end.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Perhaps. I don't know. I just...
Point well taken.
Like I said, it's not a deal breaker. I just think, you know, for as much as we're saying that this movie does a lot of things different that a lot of movies don't necessarily do, I don't think absolves it of how heavy-handed
I agree with you there.
Just in a different way. It's just, it's heavy-handed in a dark way, whereas a lot of movies are heavy-handed maybe in another way. But it's still really good. And if you're still listening at this point and you haven't seen it, great job. But also, if you're watching it on there's a two-disc DVD.
Yes.
Or a Blu-ray. And they offer the choice of watching it in color or in black and white. And black and white was Darabont's original intention, obviously, because he was making a two-hour Twilight Zone episode, which, again, the ending screams of. He wanted to do it in black and white. Apparently, that was the deal breaker for Dimension. Listen, you can have him fucking kill everyone, but we're going to do it in color, all right? But watch it in black and white, because the photography looks great. And, it was his original intention. And if nothing else, it covers up. I think it does a good job of masking the cheapness of a lot of the CGI effects, which do stand out because CGI has gotten so sophisticated.
It looks nice in black and white. The first time I saw it was in black and white.
Yeah.
And I still remember when the original DVD came out, it was the more expensive one
right.
that had the black and white version.
Right.
And I had to wait patiently because I knew it would come down.
Yeah.
I knew it would come down in price. Yeah. And it did.
Yeah. And the Blu-ray, luckily, you can pick up pretty cheap, and it has both versions. So,
does anyone anymore, man, this shows how old I am, that you could watch something on TV and adjust, take the color out?
I mean, I assume you still could, but I don't know if anybody does.
Because on the original color TV that was in my bedroom when I was a teenager, there was a knob.
Yeah.
There was a knob on the TV and no remote that you would dial it up. And very often I would watch color stuff in black and white because I love black and white.
Did anything look significantly better that you remember? Like, oh, this should have been in black and white.
Not that I remember. No.
You know what I wish they would do?
I wish I had a joke for that because that's such a perfect setup for me to come up with the funniest film.
You know what I wish they would do is take black and white movies and somehow find a way to add color to them.
They just released...
It's a Wonderful Life.
Well, that's been colorized more than
I know,
once.
But why put that on the disc? What person in 2011 that is buying that movie on Blu-ray wants the colorized version?
The new version comes with a little bell Christmas ornament.
That's the one I got.
They've just colorized the Alistair Sim version of A Christmas Carol, which is my favorite version, and it's out on Blu-ray.
My favorite version has Muppets.
Continue. And I was eyeing it, and it's really expensive.
For just the colorized version, or does it have both?
I don't know. I didn't pick it up because the price tag was like radiation, and it kept my hand from picking it up. Speaking of Blu-ray,
yes,
there is a Tom Cruise gift set being released today.
Yeah, there is.
Of all of his greatest films. And I really think they missed an opportunity to call it the Black Hole gift set. Five movies?
I think it's five. And they're not all bad.
Five movies that feature a black hole where a performance should be. Two of them are really bad.
Well, they're all the Paramount movies, right?
Yes.
So Top Gun is awful. Days of Thunder is possibly even worse than Top Gun.
Days of Thunder is worse than Top Gun.
Is it Mission Impossible 1 and 2?
None of the Mission
Impossible. Okay, Minority Report is in there.
Yes.
And that's okay. That has things to like about it.
Except Tom Cruise.
He's fine in the movie, I think.
No.
I think he's fine. I'm not saying he makes the movie better.
Black hole.
I got it.
Black hole.
Keep beating that drum. What are the other...
You can't handle the truth.
What are the other
the
two?
The truth is Tom Cruise.
I don't know the other two.
Collateral.
Okay. That's all right. It's not the worst. Listen, it's not the worst. That's all I'm saying. There's things... Actually, you know what? When
a
I saw...
A series of attempts to get him a nomination.
Perhaps. But he's a supporting role in that movie. And honestly...
And he has silver hair.
Right. Because he's a wolf? A bullet? I don't know. We shouldn't be talking about Collateral, but I will say, when I saw that movie, I liked the scene so much. In the early minutes, Jamie Foxx and Jada Pinkett Smith, neither of which I'm necessarily a huge fan of, have a very long scene where they're talking to each other in a cab. And I liked it so much that when Tom Cruise showed up to be the hitman, I was like, shit, that's what this movie is. I forgot. I want to stay with these two people in the cab. Anyway.
And, of course, that whole scene exists to establish that Jamie Foxx is a person. Because we wouldn't know that without...
Well, and then Jada Pinkett Smith comes back in the worst way. I have so many problems with Collateral. We're talking too much about Collateral and The Mist. Everyone see The Mist? Thank you for listening to our podcast. What else?
I got nothing.
Email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Talk about the ending of The Mist or don't. I don't care. I'm going to shoot JB in the head. Bye, everyone.
Please don't.